supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have one of those jam-packed shows for you today, cats and kittens. When we get to the question of the week, we'll tell you what you should do when the soil test for your lawn recommends fertilizers whose numbers start up in the 30s. You know not to use those bad things. What should you use instead? Plus, we're going to talk about backyard chickens with a gentleman from the Scott Arboretum of Swarthmore College who's holding a workshop on that coming up and who raises chickens himself. It's a lot to get done. We better get right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. James, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I am doing well, James. How are you, sir?
I'm just peachy.
And where is James Peachy?
James is Peachy in Clifton, Virginia.
Clifton, Virginia. Is that in the D.C. area?
Yeah, it's between Manassas and Fairfax.
Okay. So what can we do for James in near our nation's capital?
Well, I've got an area in my backyard that has a stand of maybe 15 or 20 large yellow pines, and they've been there for probably at least 20 years. And I would really like to be able to grow some, you know, some dependable grass underneath them. But with the soil being so acidic and somewhat shady, I've never really had anything, you know, take firmly in there. And I was wondering if you had a recommendation for that.
Most people don't understand that growing grass under trees is really unnatural. Every time I see a lawn that goes right up to a tree and ends perfectly at the tree, and neither the tree nor the lawn seem to be suffering, I'm amazed, because that's like about 2% of the time. You probably do have acidic soil. The pines are not making the soil as acidic as you may think. The issue is the dense shade cast by the trees. But also, homeowners don't think about the fierce competition for nutrients and water from the trees. So here's the conundrum you run into with growing grass under trees. The shade-loving grasses, the grasses that get by, I should say, with the least amount of sun, with about 4 hours of sun a day, are fine fescues. They are very fragile grasses in comparison to the other grasses. They don't take a lot of foot traffic. And, of course, the trees are always beating them up for their lunch money, food, and water. But plants in shade can't take a lot of food and water. So it's first you find the right grass, which can be a chore, and then it's a very delicate balancing act to try to keep that grass alive. Now, do you get 4 hours of sun underneath those trees?
I think we probably do, yeah.
And you've had the soil tested to confirm that it's highly acidic?
No, I have not. I was using my, you know, somewhat limited common sense.
That'll always get a man in trouble. You know, it's funny, if you don't have any outdoor cats roaming around, you can taste it and find out. What I would do is get a soil test done, find out just what the pH is for grass. You want it to be somewhere between 6.5 and 7, like a little acidic or approaching neutral. And then your best bet would be just to tolerate what you have over the summer and literally right around August 15th have a big load of local compost delivered, spread it about an inch deep on top of the area under the trees, and sow that with a blend of fine fescues, the most shade-tolerant grasses for your region. Unfortunately, it's a waste of time to sow grass seed in the Northeast in the spring, although the stores will be happy to sell it to you because they know they'll be selling it to you again every spring. If you needed to get something done right away, you could try to find fescue sod. You'll be able to find turf-type tall fescue, but you would be looking for sod that at least had some fine fescue in there. And the issue would be more water than food. Remember that during the summer drought, any cool season grass like this is going to be suffering greatly, and the trees are going to be stealing all the water. So my recommendation to water deeply once a week in a situation where you're trying to grow grass under trees in a DC summer, I would say 2 to 3 deep soakings a week. It would be more if you were in a dry climb, but I know what DC is like in the summertime, and that is not dry heat. But if you get the timing right and you put that nice compost seed bed down, you would have a chance, but you'd be waiting until the mid-August to get that installed. That would give you your best bet at a long-term success.
Okay. That
All right.
Sounds good. Thank you very much.
All right, James. Thank you. Take care, man.
All right. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Mary Addison, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
Hello, is that your given first name, Mary Addison?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Where are you, Mary?
I'm in Nashville.
Okay, very good. Always good to hear from our people down there. What can we do for you?
I have a night blooming series that is a offshoot of an heirloom, and it was surviving, the offshoot was surviving in water for about 3 years, and I transplanted it into just regular potting soil, and it did fine for about a year. And then I started noticing that the leaves were kind of dying and the stems were turning kind of more woodsy and brown spots. The leaves are kind of getting cracks in them. And just wondering how to either preserve it or what kind of conditions I need. I tried to take a cutting, and the cuttings are not doing so well either. And just trying to find out how to keep it alive.
I'm certainly no expert on night blooming cereus, but it is a cactus, right?
Yeah, it's a cactus. It's, I think, the more appropriately, like, I did some research. It's like the Dutchman's pipe is the other name for it.
No. Those are two totally different plants. Dutchman's pipe is a vine that is very popular. There's a Native American version. There's a California version. But that is, for instance, a very hardy, especially the kind of Native American basic Dutchman's pipe. That's a very hardy plant that lives outside and can be, you know, cut back and pruned every spring and is incredibly reliable, and it's kind of a poster child for native plants.
Okay. This one doesn't look like a cactus per se. It's got the long stem leaves that are flat, mm-hmm. and I haven't seen it bloom.
I'm stunned because you just had this thing sitting in water like a cut flower for 3 years.
Yeah. And it had a lot of roots. And when I transplanted it, it just really started getting green sprouts. So it started doing a lot better.
I'm astounded because it should have died.
Yeah.
It should have died in the water. And then when you took those roots that had never experienced the pressure of soil and put them into soil, then it should have died again. So this thing is like one of these comic book characters that, you know, it doesn't matter how many times you kill it, it keeps coming back. Why do you think it's a night blooming cereus? Did you ever see it act like that? Did you ever see it have flowers that opened up at night?
You know, once upon a time, maybe when I was a kid, and then just like I think my mom had told me that it was a night blooming cereus.
And you've kept this thing indoors all this time, right?
Yes. And it was getting southern light, mm-hmm. and I was just watering it, you know, just periodically, you know, not over-watering it.
I think what you want to do is you want to go online and you want to look these things up by their scientific names. And I will tell you that you can look up Dutchman's pipe, and it'll give you the scientific name, which is Aristoliochia. And I think that might be what you have. You might have a cutting of Dutchman's pipe, which would be fabulous, because what that would mean is in the spring, I think it's time for this thing to go outside, get planted in the ground, and let's see what it can do. I also want you to look up night blooming cereus by the scientific name, which is going to be confusing. A lot of people are going to use that term for a lot of different plants. But the bottom line is it is a cactus. It's a very hardy cactus. It's actually a cactus that's used as rootstock for difficult cactuses. And I may be wrong, but I can't see it surviving in water for that long. So I think it's Dutchman's pipe. I think you should plant it outside in an area that, you know, in Nashville gets like some sun, a little bit of afternoon shade. I think you'll get flowers from it. And by the end of the season, you'll know if this is a plant that can simply now stay outside or if you need to pot it up and bring it back in for the winter to protect it, because a true night blooming cereus is a tropical plant.
Okay. About when should I plant it outside?
If it is the basic type and not the California type, just for safety's sake, you know what I would do? Starting around mid-May, I would take it outside in its pot, leave it out for a couple of hours, bring it back in, do that for about a week, and plant it in the ground somewhere between May 15th and June 1st.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and start getting my seed starting set up. Well, set up. I have been starting early crops like lettuce and spinach for a while. Now it's time to move those cold weather lovers outside and make room for tomatoes, peppers, and cukes. Oh my! So I can plant those summertime crops in my region about 2 months from now. But don't go looking up the correct way to start those seeds in our Garden Answers A to Z section just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls, what to do when a soil test tells you to use fertilizers with real big numbers, and how you can have your very own backyard chickens. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Backyard Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 80 new varieties for the 2013 growing season, including Super Sauce, a 2-pound sauce tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, what should your reaction be if a soil test tells you to use fertilizers whose first numbers start in the 20s and 30s? You don't want to use those chemical fertilizers. We'll tell you what to do instead. We're also going to take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time for us to be, quote, feeling clucky with our interview about backyard chickens. Adam Glass is a gardener at the Scott Arboretum of Swarthmore College, where they'll be holding a workshop on backyard chickens on Thursday, March 14th. Adam, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And do you agree with me? How hot are chickens in the world today?
They're a hot topic. Everybody who is into gardening and, you know, raising their own food is all about chickens these days.
I'm going to be perfectly honest and say that although I've been a gardener for well over 30 years now, I've never even been tempted to keep my own chickens. I can barely keep my vegetables in line, much less something that's going to be moving around. And I've always worried about predators because I live out in the country, in the woods. Is that one of the biggest things that people need to pay attention to, is the fact that almost every creature on the planet that eats other creatures finds chickens very tasty, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, one of those things that you have to make sure you're putting them up at night so that, you know, fox and skunk and, you know, raccoons and possums, all those guys, they love chickens and eggs, and given the opportunity, they're gonna take advantage of it. So it's definitely one of the big concerns that you have to keep an eye out for and make sure that you're keeping your chickens safe, especially in the evening.
And it's really hard to outwit a raccoon, right? They are big and powerful, but they can make themselves small, and they're very smart.
Yeah, they're absolutely persistent, and if they put their mind to it, they'll get in there. So you really have to make sure that your coop is secure and that, you know, you're keeping an eye on things and checking things and making sure that, you know, you're keeping them safe at all times.
Now, during the day when they're out running around, there are fewer predators out. But I would presume you are going to hope that people keep them fenced in to some degree?
Yeah. With all these people coming to, you know, want have chickens in their backyard, a lot of townships and municipalities are really putting ordinances into effect that, you know, the chickens have to be in a certain sort of enclosure at all times. They're typically not allowed to free range if you live in a, you know, more urban environment. Luckily, I live in the country where my chickens can run free, but, you know, you do have to be aware of predators during the day as well, hawks especially.
I was going to say, I actually witnessed a hawk attack where the hawk went through screening. So what do you tell people? I mean, does it, you know, when somebody wants to set up a small flock, and what is a small flock? How many chicks do you buy?
I would say probably 5 to 6 is a good number for a small backyard. You know, they definitely need a certain amount of space. It's about 5 square feet per chicken of outdoor space that they need. So, you know, just depending on the amount of space you have, you want to make sure you can accommodate them.
And does almost everyone buy chicks that have been professionally started?
Yeah, most amateurs will buy chicks. It's the easiest way to start them. You know, incubating eggs is kind of a scientific and technical process that cannot be so successful. So, yeah.
So it's like a corollary to starting seeds. You're a gardener at the Scott Arboretum out at Swarthmore College. And you probably know as well as I do, and many of our listeners who've tried it, there's almost no correlation between gardening and seed starting. They're totally different arts.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I can imagine taking an egg and getting a chicken out of it is as difficult to do the first couple of times as starting your own tomato plants.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely a challenge.
So you go out and you buy your chicks, and then are people prepared for the fact that these chicks, because I think they think there's going to be this totally sustainable circle where the little baby chicks are just going to eat bugs and weed seeds and fertilize their garden and just be there. But they need heat, water, food, and of course protection. Is that the four basics?
Yeah, for starting out, yep, absolutely. They're used to being under their mother most of the time when they're born naturally, so you have to sort of replicate that environment for the first, you know, about 4 months until they get their real feathers. Yeah, you know, you just have to make sure the temperature is around 95 degrees.
Whoa!
Yeah, it's warm. For the first week, and then you drop the temperature down about 5 degrees every week thereafter until they're sort of acclimated. And like I said, get their real feathers, and then they're ready to go out into the big world.
Most people who are doing this are not going, and I'm just going to broach the subject right away, they're not going to eat these chickens, are they?
Right. Most of the chickens, you know, the eggs are sort of a bonus, but they're pets for most people.
So when is prime egg laying time? Because we get these baby chicks that are just a week or two old, right?
Right. Well, usually they're actually under 3 days old when you get
them. Really?
Yeah, they're very fresh. Prime egg laying time depends on the breed of chicken, but ideally they start laying about 5 months old. And they're productive, really productive, for about the first 2 years.
So they start let's make it 6 months to make it clean, and the first couple of years they're going to be in their good production years. But something I've learned from my farmer friends is that it's incredibly seasonal.
Yeah, absolutely. I have seven laying hens right now, and I was getting about two eggs every 3 days from the seven hens.
But the bounty is now to come.
Correct. February until about, I'd say, early October, they're really pumping out the eggs. I get about six or seven a day from the seven hens.
Okay, so about an egg a day a bird.
Yep, absolutely.
And is that the norm?
Yeah, that's typical.
Now, in the summertime, let's say you have a situation where you can either build a chicken tractor. And we won't go into that in depth, but people can look it up. It's a protective cage you move with the chickens so that they can eat bugs and weed seeds in a certain area of what'll be garden, and they'll poop all over it, and it'll be wonderful. And then you move the cage the next day, and that's the tractor moving. Or let's say they're safe to turn them out into their garden beds. How much of its own food will the average chicken be able to come up with by pecking and scratching and doing what they did in the wild when and wherever they were wild?
Yeah, I would say typically if they're free range and they have access to food and bugs and all sorts of good stuff, they're probably getting about 80% of their diet from nature.
So in the summertime, clean water would be the most important thing you can give them.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I always have supplemental feed available for them if they choose to. But like I said, in the summertime, they rarely eat it.
And I guess, though, that their food needs go up dramatically over the winter when they're not giving you much in return because they got to keep up their body heat.
Yeah, absolutely. They're definitely consuming much more supplemental feed in the wintertime.
So you're going to be doing this workshop on Thursday, March 14th, and you're going to have all these newbies, all these wannabes. I mean, we're right at the cusp of chick buying time, right?
Yep, absolutely. Now it's prime time.
What are you going to talk about now after 2 years when these birds start to slow down in their egg production? Is there an old age home for chickens? I mean, do people just eventually just, you know, little chicken walkers, keep them around because they've been there the whole time?
Yeah, I hope people, you know, realize that when they buy a baby chick, it's an investment. You know, you want to keep them for as long as you can. You don't want to be just throwing them at the side of the road and sending them along their way. It's an investment in time, and hopefully people are choosing to keep them for the long haul.
Oh, and you know, you just sparked a thought in my head when you said people buying a baby chick. I can remember when I first started this show, when I was back as the editor of Organic Gardening, pre-Easter every year, we would desperately beg people not to buy baby chicks for their children because, you what, 112% of those people were totally unprepared.
Yeah.
And it was a bad end for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
So has that practice stopped, hopefully?
You still see it today. More so with little baby bunnies than chicks. But, you know, I do encourage people that if they are thinking of purchasing a chick, that they do the research and really think about the process and what it takes to invest in having something like this in your backyard.
You have to have a good coop that has 5 square feet of space per chicken?
Yep. Outdoor space, 5 square feet. Indoor space, 2 to 3 square feet.
And roosts that they can get up on.
Yep, absolutely.
And screening.
Yep.
But it has to be insulated.
Mm-hmm.
And a heater, which I think today's is mostly an ultraviolet light or one of the, not ultraviolet, you know what I mean.
Yeah, infrared heat.
Infrared
light.
Heat.
Yep.
And you need feeders and waterers. So there is a significant investment.
Yes, absolutely.
What will be your egg return on investment, considering maybe you buy, well, I mean, you would have super premium, organic, free range eggs, which are expensive, let's say $4 a dozen.
Mm-hmm.
Will you recoup that, or is it like the $600 tomato?
Yeah, it's definitely more like the $600 tomato. You know, I definitely don't use all the eggs they produce, and, you know, I sell a dozen here and a dozen there to friends and or give them away to family, but it's not for the investment in most cases. It's for the enjoyment and the pleasure of having them in your backyard and harvesting your own eggs and making your own omelet out of your own eggs. It's definitely an added bonus and a plus.
All right. We've been talking with Adam Glass, a farmer and gardener at the Scott Arboretum of Swarthmore College, where he'll be putting on a workshop called Feeling Clucky on Thursday, March 14th at 2. We want to remind everybody, or we want to alert everybody, that you have to pre-register for this, and we don't know at this point if it's filled up or not. So call before you go, but if there's room, you'll probably learn how to grow your own eggs. Adam, thanks very much for being on You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks for having me.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Lisa, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Bob.
Hello, Lisa. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I am just fine, thank you. Where is Lisa fine?
I am in Decatur, Georgia, which is right outside Atlanta.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Lisa near Atlanta?
I have 4 anise shrubs that I planted in my backyard about 4.5 years ago, and they've kind of gotten out of control. And I don't know the best way to trim them back or shape them.
Do you know what kind of anise shrub you have?
I've been told they're Florida anise.
Well, there would be regular anise, which is the tropical plant that produces the famous scented seed that smells like licorice. I presume it's not that, right?
It's not that, no.
Anise hyssop, has anybody ever called it that?
No, I have never heard that term.
And it's not a magnolia?
No, it's definitely not a magnolia.
Okay, so we'll presume you have anise hyssop.
Okay.
Right.
These have a distinctive smell to them. Like if you break the leaves, you smell the anise smell.
Okay.
But I don't. They don't necessarily have pods that come from them. So there is an anise scent about them.
Do they have flowers?
They do, but they're not very large or distinctive.
And they're not like tall little bottle brush things that come up on top of the plant.
Nope.
You almost had me when you said that they were anise scented because the hyssop is famous for that. And it's a North American plant, but it doesn't have purple flower spikes.
I don't believe so. I've never noticed them.
Are you growing it in the shade?
It's a shady backyard, yes.
Oh, well, the lack of flowers may be lack of sun.
Oh, interesting.
How tall have they gone?
They're about 7 to 8 feet tall.
Hmm.
They're very tall, and they're not very thick. The limbs are well spaced out, and they're very long right now. They're not bushy.
Well, that could also be a factor of not enough sun. Plants get leggy when they're in enough sun, but you've long lost the tag that had the scientific name on it, right?
Yes. Yeah.
I feel like we're on Pawn Stars now. What do you want to do with this plant? Sell it or pawn it?
Well, they are very scraggly looking and kind of gotten a little out of control. And the leaves or the limbs almost seem like they're too heavy. They droop down very far when they're when the leaves are fully grown out and it's kind of wet and in the summer season.
Okay, now we're back to the hyssop again because they have weak limb structures and they have leaves that smell like licorice when you break them open.
Yep. So it seems like I should trim them back, but I don't know the right method to do that. And I've also read in some of the literature that you can basically shape them to be small trees and take off the bottom limbs and kind of force them into a tree shape. And I didn't know if that would be appropriate as well.
Well, you take a look at the plants. That's really easy to tell. There's a lot of plants you can do that with. By removing the lower limbs, you get rid of all that stuff on the bottom.
Right.
And then you're left with a little canopy on top. Would that please you?
I think so. Does it affect how the top grows? Like, would it grow larger at the top?
Yeah, it's so hard to say. Are these things fed, mulched? You say, is it always wet out there, you said?
It's wet 3/4 of the year. In the height of summer, it does get dry, but we do water them.
Right.
And we mulch them every year.
With what?
cypress mulch.
You could be physically harming the plants then. You could be helping them be scraggly.
Okay.
Get rid of the cypress mulch.
Okay.
And you shouldn't be buying cypress mulch. You know, they're taking down cypress trees, which are endangered, to make that mulch. And that's not a proper thing to be buying anymore. There's people calling for that to be taken off the market. And it's no safer than any other kind of wood in terms of termites or fungal matter. You know, what you might want to do is give it a gentle pruning this spring. After it starts to green up again a little bit more, show its new growth.
Yep.
But I would get rid of the old mulch. I would spread compost underneath it. Why is it always wet out there?
It's a very shady backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And we do get a lot of rain in the area.
Yeah.
So,
is there anything you can do to divert water away from it, change gutters? Uh-huh. Are there any other plants that could be cut back to give it a little bit more sun?
It is in between two larger trees, so we can cut back the limbs of the other trees that are over them.
Yeah, unless you like them. You know, it sounds like these plants are really struggling there. If they are the anise plants that I think, they would probably prefer to be transplanted to a spot that it gets more sun and drains better. Is that an option? Then you could put some kind of swampy plant back there.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not. Our entire backyard is very shaded.
Yeah, okay. Well, your options are to replace them with something that's going to do better in the shade.
Okay.
You can cut them back as much as you want this spring. It doesn't sound like we have anything to lose, right?
Okay. Yeah, I just didn't know if it was going to totally take them out or not.
And if you want to trim your trees to open up the area for more light and air, that's great. But really look at what you're doing first and make sure that's what you want, because it's very hard to go back in with duct tape and super glue.
Right.
All right. I feel like I was no help at all, but hopefully it gave you some things to think about.
It did definitely give me some things to think about. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, Lise.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn those who'd like to see me in person that I'll appear at the Fredericksburg Home and Garden Show in Fredericksburg, Virginia, March 15th through the 17th, at the Radnor Memorial Library in Wayne, PA, Wednesday, April 3rd, at the Delaware Home Show in Dover, April 6th and 7th, and at the, wait for it, Fishing Creek Herb Guild in Bloomsburg, PA, on Thursday, April 18th. Don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to read those soil test reports for your lawn. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 80 new varieties for the 2013 growing season, including Super Sauce, a 2-pound sauce tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Thank you. Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. What to do when you send in your soil and it gets tested and they come back with recommendations for really overpoweringly high-strength chemical fertilizers? We'll assess this topic from all angles after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Marty, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Marty. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
And where is Marty well?
I'm very well in Wayne, Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia.
Very good. What can we do for Marty in Wayne? Or you could even be Wayne and Marty.
No, it's actually Marty and Wayne. But
there
anyway, so I have maybe something that is a little unusual for this time of the year, but I'm trying to think ahead.
Gotcha.
I've got this bed of Pachysandra that I'd like to get rid of, and I guess my overriding concern is I don't want to break my back doing it because I'm well aware of the mat of roots underneath. And I've seen some suggestions that say cut it with a lawnmower and then cover it with black plastic and let nature take its course.
Because nature does that all the time, right, Marty? The last time I saw nature, she was dragging a lawnmower and a big roll of plastic behind her.
You know? Well, I don't want to use any chemicals.
And, right, good man.
And I realize I might be in for some back-breaking labor, but...
No, you don't have to be. Now, what's the replacement plan?
I'm just planning on seeding it with grass in the fall.
Okay. So. All right, so you already know that the fall is the best time to do the grass seed.
Yes, I do.
I would agree with getting out there with a lawnmower and scalping it. Like, right now, for instance... This is a situation where you don't have to wait for the soil to dry out. You're not trying to do anything right. You wish to kill the plant.
Yes,
so
that's true.
I would go out there and really scalp it. This is the one situation where it's good to see dirt blowing out the back of the mower. And then rake all that debris up and compost it somewhere. And then as we get into the growing season, you got two choices. First, I would scalp it several times. I would, like, give it three runs, let some new leaves come up, scalp it again, let some new leaves come up, and then scalp it again. Now, this area is in shade by definition because it's Pachysandra, right?
Yes, it is. A little bit of shade.
Okay. Little bit or a lot?
Well, I guess you could say a lot.
A lot of shade, right.
Yeah, it's not dark. It gets a little bit of sun late in the afternoon, but not a lot.
If this were a ground cover in full sun, one of your options would be to till up the area, level it out, saturate the soil, and cover it with clear plastic. That's how you solarize the soil. That's how you bake all the roots and weed seeds and pathogens out of the soil. But that's not going to work for you because you don't have that sunlight. I don't think it would do you any good to drag black plastic over top of it. How close is the Pachysandra to the side of the house?
Well, it abuts the front of the house, and that's part of the reason I want to get rid of it. It's easier to maintain the house if I don't have to, if I don't have to worry about crushing the plants or
right.
That sort of thing. So.
And what color is the house?
The fascia is white at the moment with brick on one side.
Yeah. See, if it wasn't a white house, you could cover it with wood chips or shredded bark, but that would be an invitation for artillery fungus spores.
I see what you're saying. Yeah,
to
sure.
Breed in the wood mulch. So here's what we're going to do. We are going to scalp this repeatedly. Maybe we're going to scalp it four times. In between each scalping, I want you to allow it to grow some true leaves. But then scalp it again as soon as it gets some leaves. Let's exhaust some of the root. Let's rope-a-dope it. Let's make it exhaust some of its energy from the root system but not be able to get any back from photosynthesis. And then I'd say pretty early in the season, like by June 1st, I want you to go out there and cover the entire area with at least one layer of cardboard.
Okay.
Maybe two. Would be a good idea. And then you simply need to put something on top of that cardboard that's going to fortify it, hold it down, you know, make things even worse for the Pachysandra. You're going to bring in some compost or topsoil to seed the lawn?
Yeah, the township actually provides compost, leaf mulch compost, so...
put down
as much as I can haul, you know.
Put down a couple layers of cardboard after repeated scalpings, and then have your compost delivered and let it sit on top. I mean, a foot deep, preferably. I realize it's not going to be the most attractive thing, but you will be the only person to have your compost ready, for instance, when you're ready to seed the lawn, and that will smother the pachysandra underneath over the course of a nice hot summer, and then you'll be ready to rock and roll. And the compost won't cause any kind of fungal problems, so your house won't be endangered.
Well, that sounds great.
All right, man?
Sounds like a plan. Thank you so much.
All right. Good luck. And remember, your window for seeding the lawn is August 15th to September 30th.
Sounds good. Thank you.
All right, man. Good luck.
All right. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks for making a call.
Thank you for making it, Bob. Where are you, sir?
Westbury, Long Island, which is, of course, New York.
Okay. Very good. What can we do for you?
I was listening to your wonderful show last week. You had a guest on discussing poison ivy.
Right.
When I was growing up, we had all different types of poison ivies. There was poison sumac, poison oak, poison ivy. And I was curious to know, are they one and the same, or is there a different strain? Is one more powerful than the other?
Poison ivy and poison oak are almost essentially the same plant. They are in the same genus. They are just different species of the same plant. Poison ivy tends to be much more of a vine-like structure. It really vines all the time. Poison oak often presents more like a shrub. Sometimes it will take on a vining habit, but poison oak really gets more into the shrub-like form. Luckily, the leaf structure, the leaves that are three, and the distinct colorations you know to look for over time are almost exactly the same. Most of what I see is poison ivy, is the big vines going up trees or the vines going up fences or, you know, just crawling across the ground because they don't have a lot of uprightness in their system. But it's good for people to know that there could be a poison ivy-like shrub that would be upright. And, you know, there's also a lot of plants that mimic poison ivy. But in this case, it doesn't.
Well, it's pretty interesting stuff. I've always learned three leaves and shiny. Stay away from it.
Yes, the three leaves is so distinctive. There is a vine in my neck of the woods called Virginia Creeper. A lot of people have this vine. And the leaf structure is very similar. It grows in the same places as poison ivy. They often kind of cross paths, so to speak. And I will be giving somebody a little tour of my garden. And they'll go, oh my God, all this poison ivy is around. And I go, no, that's Virginia creeper. If you count, there's always five leaves in a pattern on it. But it looks so much like poison ivy. And what I always try to warn people is because poison ivy does vine so easily, it often goes up into a tree and then drops back down again. So you can innocently push what you think is a tree branch out of your way, and it's actually a poison ivy vine that's come down the other way, and you come out of the woods with a terrible rash, and you were so careful not to touch anything on the ground that had three leaves. But a poison ivy can come at you both ways. And yes, the leaves are very shiny. And one of the things the experts we've had on the show talk about is it's good to know what these plants look like in all their forms. You know, they look very different. The young plants, the poison ivy plants, have a lot of red in them. And then towards the end of the season, poison ivy itself turns a brilliant red. It is a great fall color plant. That's one great way to spot it in your property, is when everything changes color in the fall, that really brilliant dusky red, that tends to be poison ivy.
Yeah, growing up on Long Island, it's woodsy, it's green, and I've gotten it more times, every form, I guarantee it, from trees, from bushes, from vines, and it's a horrible thing to have. And as a young boy, you'd, of course, you know, it would spread all over your body, and it's definitely no fun.
Just remember, if you think you've been exposed, you have a good 10, 20 minutes to wash yourself off with cool water, and that'll dissolve the oil before it can affect you.
Not hot, soapy water.
Oh, no, 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 no. The hot opens up your pores and forces the oil in, and then the oil gets on the soap. No, whatever you use should be cool. Water is the best, and a good second bet is alcohol.
Oh, that's good information to have. It makes perfect sense. Thanks a lot. I love your show, and I appreciate taking the call.
As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Soil test recommendations. Be careful with big numbers. Alexis Landis, You Bet Your Garden producer, please read this week's intriguing question.
We heard from David in Havertown, Pennsylvania, who writes, I recently had my lawn soil analyzed by the soil test lab at Penn State University. Their suggestion for the amount of limestone I should add to bring up my soil's pH is quite clear, but they give endless recommendations on fertilizers, none of which seem to actually match the numbers on any bags of lawn food at garden centers. Two of the many ratios they listed are 32:4:10 and 36:12. They suggest I pick a fertilizer that matches or is close to one on the list and use it three times during the growing season. Some of the offerings in a famous four-step program come close at 30:04 and 28:14, but nothing matches any of Penn State's numbers exactly. What defines close regarding ratios? I appreciate your advice.
Well, first, I want to assure our diehard organic listeners that I emailed Dave back, and he quickly decided to use organic fertilizers instead of the super high potency chemical ones that were recommended. How do I know that by definition those numbers refer to chemical fertilizers? That's easy. Every package of fertilizer, by law, displays three numbers. The first is the relative amount of nitrogen in the product, the second is phosphorus, and the third is potassium. These are often known by the abbreviations NPK. Now, the highest known sources of natural nitrogen, things like corn gluten meal, poultry manure, and bat and seabird guanos, top out around 10. Maybe up as high as 12 or 13 for a really potent guano, but that's about it. Any first number that's up in the 20s or 30s is definitely a chemical salt of nitrogen. So I called the soil test lab at Penn State, and the manager explained that they have no actual control over the recommendations that get printed out on the tests. That information is dictated by Penn State's turf grass department, who we are waiting to hear back from. Now, it's hard to estimate exactly how many pounds of nitrogen those fertilizers would supply in real life. To know that, you'd need to know the weight of the bag and its avowed coverage area. But it's clear that these are the exact kinds of fertilizers that are being outlawed in many parts of the country to try and protect wildlife and water supplies from nasty runoff. So what's a homeowner who wants a nice lawn without damaging local waterways and wildlife to do? Think 10, as in 10% nitrogen. Fresh grass clippings are about 10% nitrogen by weight, and a ratio of 10:1:1 is about the ideal for a lawn fertilizer. A nice amount of nitrogen and a pinch of phosphorus and potassium. So that's what you want to see on a bag of slow-release natural lawn fertilizer. A first number that's between, say, a low of 8 and a high of 12, and zeros, ones, or twos for the other two numbers. For cool season lawns, that's fescue, bluegrass, and rye, you'd use a natural fertilizer that supplies about a pound of nitrogen per 1,000 square feet of turf early in the spring and again in the late summer or early fall. If you use corn gluten meal for these feedings, you'll also get some natural pre-emergent herbicide effect, defeating dormant crabgrass seed in the spring and preventing some dandelions, chickweed, and clover in the fall. But with warm season grasses like Bermuda, Zoysia, and St. Augustine, they should get three equal feedings over the summer. Just the opposite of the timing for cool season lawns, because these grasses truly are the opposites of each other. Or use compost instead of a bagged fertilizer for any of the feedings, especially the fall feeding for cool season lawns. Compost doesn't have big numbers, but an inch raked into the surface of your lawn creates some of the healthiest, greenest grass you'll ever see. The power of organic matter in action. Now a little praise for Penn State. In the Maintaining a Home Lawn recommendations at their website, they urge homeowners to use less fertilizer than more, to never feed a cool season lawn in the heat of the summer, and to return grass clippings to the lawn rather than collect them. As I said earlier, those clippings are full of nitrogen, as am I, and returning them to your lawn, especially in the pulverized form a true mulching mower provides, gives your lawn a nice natural feeding every time you mow. Penn State says it provides a third of the food your lawn requires in any given season, which would eliminate the third feeding that they recommend and that I don't. It's also the only safe way to dispose of clippings if your lawn has been treated with the chemical herbicides I certainly hope you don't foolishly use. And Penn State and many other State Extension Service soil test labs will provide organic alternatives to their fertilizer recommendations. All you got to do is ask, either when you send in the test sample or after you get the results. We'll even provide a link to Penn State's organic recommendation brochure in the online version of this question of the week. It's pretty good. Well, that sure was some useful information about having a nice-looking lawn without putting the old skull and crossbones on local waterways, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website, where you can read it over with links to lots more information about sustainable lawn care. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to give me a shot of 30-something-something if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Put the actual subject of your email in the subject line. Wouldn't that be fun? And check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section. Listen to this show, listen to old shows, download this week's podcast, and follow us on Facebook. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's Internet Illuminati. Our social media director, Amanda McGrath, and our ace production assistant, Brett Rader, are both naturally under 30. Taking the fifth on this issue is our esteemed editor, Al Banks. I am gentlemanly enough that I would never guess a number for Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'll just note that she seems as young as corn gluten. I'm ancient Mike McGrath. And hey, if you pass 30 twice, should people trust you again? And I'll see you next week. Sooner or later, into every life, a little fruit fly will, well, fly. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll detail my very own household's heroic and successful battle against the little devils, plus your fabulous phone calls.